in short coats. Men wear trousers and long coats. Everyone wears boots. I have 3 outfits custom made on landfall. Maybe we can, make do with them until I can get you 2 to a tailor. Boots. Mine would fit you like socks on a rooster. We can wrap your feet so that a pair will stay on long enough to get you to a bootery. We won't worry about that now. Join the conference. Standing up and wet or sitting down and comfortable.
Estrellita bit her lip and decided in favor of comfort.
Minerva, those youngsters were brighter than I had expected. At first they studied because I told them to, but once they tasted the magic of the printed word, they were hooked. They learned to read like grass through a goose, and didn't want to do anything else, especially stories. I had a good library, mostly in micro, thousands of those, but also a few dozen valuable bound books, facsimile antiques I'd picked up on landfall where they speak English and use Galacta only as a trade tongue. Savvy Oz books, Minerva? Yes, of course you do. I helped plan the Great Library and included my childhood favorites as well as more sober things. I did make sure that Joe and Yita read a spread of sober stuff, but mostly I let them wallow in stories. The just-so stories, in the Oz books, and Alice in Wonderland, and A Child's Garden of Verses, and 2 Little Savages, and such. Too limited. They were books from my childhood, 3 centuries before the diaspora. On the other hand, every human culture in the galaxy derives from that one. But I tried to make sure that they understood the difference between fiction and history. Difficult, as I wasn't certain that there was a difference. Then I had to explain that a fairy tale was still a different sort, one step farther along the spectrum from fact to fancy. Minerva, this is very hard to explain to an inexperienced mind. What is magic? You are more magical than any magic in fairy tales, and it does no good to say that you are a product of science rather than magic in speaking to kids who have no idea what is meant by science. And I wasn't sure that the distinction was valid even when I was explaining the distinction. In my wanderings, I have run across magic many times, which simply says that I have seen wonders I could not explain. I finally let it go by asserting ex cathedra, that some stories were just for fun and not necessarily true. Gulliver's Travels were not the same sort of thing as The Adventures of Marco Polo, while Robinson Crusoe lay somewhere in between, and they should ask me, if in doubt. They did ask sometimes and accepted my decision without argument, but I could see that they did not always believe me. That pleased me. They were starting to think for themselves. Didn't matter if they were wrong. Yita was simply politely respectful to me about Oz. She believed in the Emerald City with all her heart, and if she had had her druthers, she would have been going there rather than to Valhalla. Well, so would I. The important thing was that they were cutting the cord. I did not hesitate to use fiction in teaching them. Fiction is a faster way to get a feeling for alien patterns of human behavior than is non-fiction. It is one stage short of actual experience, and I had only months in which to turn these cowed and ignorant animals into people. I could have offered them psychology and sociology and comparative anthropology. I had such books on hand, but Joe and Yita could not have put them together into a gestalt. And I recall another teacher who used parables and putting over ideas. They read every hour I would let them, huddled together like puppies and staring at the reading machine and nagging each other about how fast to raise the pages. Usually, Yita nagged Joe. She was quicker than he. But as may be, they spurred each other from illiterate to speed readers in zip time. I didn't let them have sound and picture tapes. I wanted them to read. Couldn't let them spend all their time reading. They had to learn other things, not just saleable skills, but much more important, that aggressive self-reliance necessary to a free human, which they totally lacked when I saddled myself with them. Shucks, I wasn't certain they had the potential. They might have been bred out of their line, but if the spark was in them, I had to find it and fan it into a flame, or I would never be able to make them run free. So I forced them to make up their own minds as much as possible, while being cautiously rough on them in other ways, and greeted every sign of rebellion, silently, in my mind, as a triumphant proof of progress. I started by teaching Joe to fight, just hand to hand. I didn't want either of us killed. One compartment was fitted as a gymnasium, with equipment that could be adapted for G or for freefall. I used it that hour a day of lowered temperature. Here I worked Joe out. Ida was required to attend, but just to exercise, although I had in mind that it might spur Joe along if his sister saw him getting the way knocked out of him. Joe needed that spur. He had a terrible time getting it through his head that it was okay to hit or kick me, that I wanted him to try, that I would not be angry if he succeeded, but that I would be angry if he didn't try his darndest. Took a while. At first he wouldn't chop at me no matter how wide open I left myself, and when I got him past that, calling him names and taunting him, he still hesitated that split second that let me close and chop him instead. But one afternoon, he got the idea so well that he landed a good one on me, and I hardly had to hold him back to let him land it. After supper, he got his reward, permission to read a bound book, one with pages. He dressed in a pair of my surgical gloves and warned that I would clobber him if he got it dirty or tore a page. Yida wasn't permitted to touch it. This was his prize. She sulked and didn't even want to use the reading machines until he asked if it was all right for him to read aloud to her. I ruled that she could even read it with him as long as she didn't touch it. So she snuggled up close, head by his, happy again, and started bossing him about turning the pages. Next day she asked me why she could not learn to fight, too. No doubt she was finding solo exercise a bore. I always found it so, and did it only because it was needful to stay in shape. No telling what hazards next groundfall might bring. Minerva, I've never felt that women should have to fight. It is a male's business to protect females and children, but a female should be able to fight because she may have to. So I agreed, but we had to change the rules. Joe and I had been working out by dockside rules. No rules, that is, save that I didn't tell him that I planned not to do him any permanent damage and did not intend to let him give me anything worse than bruises. But I never said this. If he could manage it, he was free to gouge out one of my eyes and eat it. I just made damn sure that he didn't. But females are built differently from males. I could not let Yida work out with us until I devised a plastron to protect her tits. Necessary. She was a bit oversized in that department, and we could have hurt her without intending to. Then I told Joe privately that bruises were okay, but if he broke one of her bones, I would break one of his, just for drill. But I put no restrictions on his sister, and I underestimated her. She was twice as aggressive as he was, untrained but fast, and she meant business. The second day we worked out with her, not only was she wearing that plastron, her brother and I were wearing jock straps, and Yida had been allowed to read a real book the night before. Joe turned out to have talent for cooking, so I encouraged him to be as fancy as ship's stores permitted while crowding her to become an adequate cook. A man who can cook can support himself anywhere. But anyone, male or female, should be able to cook, keep house, and care for children. I hadn't located a trade for Yida, although she displayed a talent for mathematics once I set up inducements for that, too. That was encouraging. A person who can read and write and has a head for math can learn anything she needs to know. So I started her on bookkeeping and accounting, from books, not helping her, and required Joe to learn to use all the tools the ship boasted. Not many, mainly maintenance gear, and supervised him closely. I didn't want him losing fingers or ruining tools. I was hopeful,
Then the situation changed. 3,100 words omitted.
Easy to say that I was stupid. I'd raised Doc and a good many children. Being ship surgeon as well as everything else, I'd given them the most thorough examinations my equipment permitted when we were a couple of days out. Quite thorough for those days. I had not practiced medicine after leaving Ormuzd, but did keep my sick bay stocked and equipped, and picked up the latest tapes whenever I was on a civilized planet and studied them during long jumps. I was a good jack-leg doctor, Minerva. The kids were as healthy as they looked, aside from slight dental caries in him, two small cavities. I noticed that the factor's allegation about her was correct. Virgo intacta, semilunar hymen, unfrayed, so I used my smallest speculum. She neither complained nor tensed up nor asked what I was looking for. I concluded that they had had regular checkups and other medical attention, far more than slaves on Blessed usually received. She had 32 teeth in perfect condition but could not tell me when the last 4 molars had erupted, just that it was not long ago. He had 28 teeth and so little space in his jaw for adult molars that I anticipated trouble. But x-ray prints showed no buds. I cleaned and filled the cavities and made note that he must have those fillings removed and the tissue regenerated on Valhalla and be inoculated against further decay. Valhalla had good dentistry, far superior to what I could do. Yida could not tell me when she had last menstruated. She discussed it with Joe. He tried to count on his fingers how many days it had been since they had been taken from their home place, as they agreed that it was before that. I told her to let me know next time and each time so that I could determine her cycle. I gave her a tin of napkins, emergency supplies I hadn't known I had. Must have been in the ship 20 years. She did tell me, and I had to open the tin for her. Neither of them knew how. She was delighted with the little elastic panty included in the package and often wore it when she did not need it, as dress-up. The kid was crazy about clothes. As a slave, she had never had a chance to pamper her vanity. I told her it was all right as long as she washed it every time she wore it. I clamped down hard on cleanliness, inspecting their ears, sending them from the table to scrub their nails and so forth. They had received no more training than a hog. She never had to be told twice. I picked on him and made sure that he met my standards, too. I found myself being more exacting with myself. I could not bring dirty fingernails to the table or skip a shower because I was sleepy. I had set the standards and had to live up to them. She was almost as unskilled a seamstress as she was a cook, but she taught herself because she liked clothes. I dug out some right-colored trade cloth and let her have fun, and used it as carrot and stick. Wearing anything became a privilege that depended on good behavior. I put a stop that way, well, mostly, to her nagging a brother. I wouldn't work with Joe. Clothes did not interest him. But if he rated it, I gave him more of a working over during exercise period. Seldom, he was not the problem she was. One evening, 3 or 4 of her periods later, I noticed on my calendar that she was past due, having forgotten the matter. Minerva, I never walked into their staterooms without knocking. Shipboard life required such privacy as can be managed. Too little, that is. Her door was open and her room was empty. I tapped on his door, got no answer. Went in, looked for her in the wardroom and galley, even in our little gym. I decided that she must be taking a bath, and I would speak to her in the morning. As I passed his stateroom again and heading back to my cabin, his door opened. She stepped out and closed it behind her. I said, "Oh, there you are," or some such. "I thought Joe was asleep." "He's just gone to sleep," Yida said. "Do you want him, Captain? Shall I wake him?" I said, "No, I was looking for you." But I tapped on his door 5 or 10 minutes ago and got no answer. She was contrite over not having heard my knock. "I'm sorry, Captain. I guess we were so busy we didn't hear you." She told me how they were busy.
which I had figured out, having suspected it from the moment I noticed that she was a week overdue after being clock regular. That's understandable. From the moment I noticed that she was a week overdue after being clock regular. That's understandable, I said. I'm glad my knock didn't disturb you. We try never to disturb you with it, Captain, she answered with sweet seriousness. We wait till you go to your cabin at night, or sometimes when you take a siesta. I said, goodness, dear, you don't have to be that careful. Do your work and keep your study hours, then do as you please the rest of the time. Starship Libby is not a sweatship. I want you kids to be happy. Can't you get it through your fuzzy head that you are not a slave? Apparently she could not quite, Minerva, for she still fretted that she had not heard my knock and jumped to respond. I said, don't be silly, Yeeta. It'll keep till tomorrow. But she insisted she wasn't sleepy and was ready and anxious to do whatever I wanted, which made me a touch nervous. Minerva, one of the oddities about Eros is that women are never so willing as when they just have, and there was nothing in Yeeta's background to inhibit her. Worse, I found that I was aware of her as a ripe female for almost the first time since the two came aboard. She was standing close to me in a narrow passageway, carrying in one hand one of those weird costumes she delighted in making, and was a bit whiff from happy exercise. I was tempted, and felt certain that she would respond at once, and happily. The thought crossed my mind that she was already pregnant, nothing to fret about. But I had gone to much trouble with these ephemerals to shift from slave owner to father figure, stern but loving. If I took her, I would lose that and add one more disturbing variable to a problem already too complex, so I grasped the nettle. Captain Sheffield said, "Very well, Yeeta. Come to my cabin." He headed toward it. She followed. Once there, he offered her a seat. She hesitated, then put her gaudy dress down and sat on it. Thoughtfulness that pleased him, as the ignorant animal she had been would not have been capable of it. The humanizing process was working. He did not comment. "Yeeta, your period is a week overdue, is it not?" "It is, Captain." She seemed puzzled, but not troubled. Sheffield wondered if he could be mistaken. After he had taught her how to open a sealed tin, he had turned over to her the limited emergency supply, warning her that if she used it too lavishly, she would have to fashion by hand some make-do, as Valhalla was months away. Then he had dismissed the matter, other than to log it on his desk calendar whenever she reported onset. Could he have failed to notice? There had been 3 days last week when he had kept to his cabin, leaving the young people on their own and having his meals sent in, a habit he had when he wanted to concentrate on a problem. During such periods he ate little and slept not at all, and barely noticed anything not part of what he was studying. Yes, it was possible.
"Don't you know, Yeeta? If you were on time, then you failed to report it."
"Oh, no, Captain." She was round-eyed with distress. "You told me to tell you, and I have. Every time. Every time." Further questions showed first that despite her new grasp of arithmetic, she did not know when she should have experienced onset. And second, that it had not been last week, but a much longer time. Time to tell her.
"Yeeta, dear, I think you're going to have a baby."
Her mouth dropped open again, her eyes rounded.
"Oh, wonderful!" she added. "May I run tell Josie? May I please? I'll be right back."
"Whoops, don't rush things. I said only that I thought so. Don't get your hopes up yet, and don't bother Joe with it till we know. Many a girl has gone much longer than a week past her date, and it didn't mean a thing. But I'm pleased to learn that you want it, child, as it appears you've had every opportunity. Tomorrow I'll examine you and try to find out."
What did he have aboard for a pregnancy test? damn it, if he must abort her, it should be as quickly as possible, when it's no worse than plucking a splinter. Then, no, there wasn't so much as a Monday morning pill in the ship, much less modern contraception. Woody, blast your stupid soul, don't ever go into space again so poorly equipped. In the meantime, don't get excited. But women always did get excited by it, of course. She was as dashed as she had been jubilant.
We tried so hard. Everything in the Kama Sutra and more. I thought we ought to ask you to show us what we were doing wrong, but Joe was certain we were doing it right.
I think Joe is correct.
Sheffield got up, poured a cup of wine for each of them while performing legerdemain, which dosed her such that she would go to sleep before long. After some relaxed talk that she might not remember, he wanted the full picture.
Here.
She looked at it dubiously.
I'll get silly. I know. I had a chance to try it once.
This isn't the pop skull they sell on Blessed. This is wine I fetched from Landfall. Pipe down and drink it. Here's to your baby if you're having one. Or here's to good luck next time.
But how to handle that next time? If his worries were well grounded. These kids must not be saddled with a defective. A healthy baby would be burden enough while they were learning to stand on their own feet. Could he stave things off to Valhalla, then get her on proper contraception? Then what? Split them up? How?
Tell me about it, dear. When he came aboard, were you virgin?
Oh, yes, certainly. They always kept me locked in that virgin's basket, except when they shut me up and brother had to sleep in the barracks, you know, when I bleed.
She took a deep breath and smiled.
Now is ever so much nicer. Josie and I tried for the longest time to get around that awful steel basket, but we couldn't. Hurt him to try, and some ways we tried hurt me, too. Finally we gave up and just did fun things we had always done.
Brother said to be patient. It wouldn't be forever.
Because we knew we would be sold together, as a breeding pair.
Estrellita looked radiant.
And so we were. And now we are. And thank you, Captain.
No, it wasn't going to be easy to split them up.
Ida, have you ever thought of being bred by some other man than Joe?
Sound her out, at least. It won't be hard to find her a husband. She's really quite attractive, that Earth Mother feeling. She looked puzzled.
Why, of course not. We knew what we were way back when we were almost babies. Our mother told us, and so did the priest. I've always slept with my brother, all my life. Why would I want anyone else?
You seemed ready enough to sleep with me. You claimed you were eager, too.
Oh, that's different. That's your right. But you didn't want me,
she added, almost accusingly.
That wasn't quite it, Ida. There were reasons that I won't go into now. Not to take you, no matter if I wanted you, and you were willing. Although it was Joe you really wanted, you said so.
Well, yes, but I was disappointed just the same. I had to tell Brother you wouldn't have me, which hurt all over again. But he said to be patient. We waited 3 more days before he broached me. In case you changed your mind.
Nagging wife vertically. Docile horizontally. Not too uncommon a pattern, Sheffield thought. He found that she was looking at him with sober interest.
Do you want me now, Captain? Joe told me that very night he decided to go ahead, that it was still your right and always would be. And it is.
Beelzebub's brass balls. The only way to avoid a willing female was to go off-planet.
Dear, I'm tired. And you are getting sleepy.
She swallowed a yawn.
I'm not that tired. I never am. Captain, the night I first asked you, I was a tiny bit scared. But I'm not scared now. I want to, if you will.
You're very sweet, but I am very tired.
Why isn't that dose taking hold?
He changed the subject.
Aren't those little bunks almost impossible for two people?
She chuckled right through another yawn.
Almost.
Once we fell out of Brother's bunk, so now we use the deck.
The deck? Why, Yuta, that's dreadful. We must do something about it.
Put the kids in here. The only full-sized bed in the ship. A bride needed a proper workbench for her honeymoon, which this was. She was deeply in love and should make the most of it, no matter what. Sheffield had decided centuries back that the saddest thing about ephemerals was that their little lives rarely held time enough for love.
Oh, the deck isn't bad, Captain. We slept on the floor all our lives.
She yawned again, could not suppress it.
Well, tomorrow we'll make better arrangements.
No, his cabin wouldn't do. His desk was in here, and his papers and files. The kids would be in his way, and he in theirs. Could he and Joe convert two narrow bunks into one double bed? Probably, although it would nearly fill one stateroom. No matter. That bulkhead between their rooms was not structural. Cut a door, and they would have a suite. A bridal suite. For a sweet bride. Yes. He added,
Let's get you to bed before you fall out of that chair. Everything's going to be all right, dear. I'll damn well see to it. And tomorrow night, and from now on, you and Joe can sleep together in a wide bed.
Really? Oh, that would be... She yawned again.
Lovely.
He had to steady her into her stateroom. She was asleep as she hit the bunk. Sheffield looked down at her, said softly, Poor little kitten. He leaned down and kissed her, and went back to his cabin. There he dug out everything the slave factor had offered as proof of the alleged odd genetic heritage of Yuta and Joe, and gave each item intense study. He was looking for clues to truth or falsity of the allegation that they were mirror twins, complementary diploids having the same mother and father. From such clues, he hoped to estimate the probability of unfavorable gene reinforcement in any child Yuta and Joe might have. The problem seemed to divide into three simplified cases. The two might be no relation to each other. Chance of a bad reinforcement, slight. Or they might be the usual sort of brother and sister. Chance of bad reinforcement, too high to be ignored. Or they might be, as alleged, zygotes resulting from complementary gametes. All genes conserved at reduction division, but with no duplication. In this case, the chance of unfavorable reinforcement would be... what? Let that wait. First assumption, that they were no relation but simply raised together from babyhood. No special hazard. Forget it. Second assumption, that they might be full siblings of the usual sort. Well, they did not look like it. But more important, that scoundrel had set up a most elaborate store for such a swindle, and had used publicly the name of a bishop to back him up. The bishop might be just as crooked. Likely, he knew that priesthood too well. But why so careless when slave babies were so cheap? No. Even if he assumed a swindle, there was no reason to expect an unnecessary risk in a setup so elaborate. So forget that, too. Yuta and Joe were not sister and brother in the ordinary sense, although they might have shared the same host mother's womb. The latter, if true, was of no genetic significance. So the remaining worry concerned the chance that the slave factor had told the truth. In which case, what were the chances of a bad cross? How many ways could such artificially produced zygotes recombine unfavorably? Sheffield tried to set up the problem while cursing the lack of sufficient data, plus the fact that the only real computer in the ship was the piloting computer, which could not be programmed for a genetics problem. He wished Libby were aboard. Andy would have stared at the bulkhead a few minutes, then come up with answers definite, where possible, and expressed in probability percentages were not. A genetics problem, even with all pertinent data, many thousands, was too unwieldy to solve without computer assistance. Well, try some simplified, illustrative problems and see what insight could be gained. Primary assumption? Yida and Joe were mirror twins, genetically complementary zygotes from the same parents, and see what insight could be gained. Primary assumption? Yida and Joe were mirror twins, genetically complementary zygotes from the same parent zygotes. Control assumption. They were unrelated other than being part of the home planet's gene pool. An extreme assumption. As slaves from the same area were likely to derive from a much smaller gene pool, which might be still further reduced by inbreeding. But this most favorable normal breeding pattern was the correct control against which he must measure. Simplified example. Test one gene site. Call it site 187 of the 21st chromosome. For reinforcement, masking, or elimination of an assumed bad gene under each assumption. Arbitrary assumption. Since this site might hold an unfavorable gene, or two, or none, in its gene pair, assume that the chance was exactly the same for both primary and control assumptions. And even, i.e., 25% no bad gene in the pair at the site, 50% one bad gene, 25% two bad genes, an extreme condition since over the generations, reinforcement, two bad genes at one site, tended toward non-survival, either lethal or reducing a zygote's ability to compete. Never mind. Make it even for both of them. There were no data on which to base any better assumption. Whoops. If a bad reinforcement was visibly demonstrated, or could be shown by tests, such zygotes would not be used. A scientist competent to attempt this experiment would use specimens as clean in a genetic sense as possible, free of all the hundreds, thousands now, of identifiable hereditary defects. The primary assumption should include this subsidiary assumption. These young people were free of any defects Sheffield could detect in a shipboard examination, which enhanced the probability that this horse thief had told the truth, and these exhibits were sober records of an exotic and successful experiment in gene manipulation. Sheffield now tended to believe that the experiment had taken place, and wished that he had the resources of a major Howard clinic, say the one on Secundus, to give these kids a genetic going over that he was not equipped to do aboard ship, and not qualified to do in any case. One nagging doubt lay in how he had acquired these kids. Why had that Gonoff been so anxious to sell, if they were what the exhibits claimed? Why sell them, when breeding the two created complements back together was the next step of the experiment? Well, perhaps the kids knew, but he had not asked the right questions. Certain it was that they had been brought up to believe that such was their proper destiny. Whoever planned this had induced in the kids from earliest childhood a pair bond stronger than most marriages in Sheffield's long experience, more than any of his own, except one. Sheffield put it out of his mind and concentrated on the theoretical consequences. At the selected site, each parent zygote had been assumed to have three possible states or gene pairs in probability 25, 50, 25. Under the control assumption, parents, diploid zygotes, both male and female, would show this distribution at the selected site. 25% good-good, clean at that site. 25% good-bad, bad gene masked, but could be transmitted. 25% good-bad, bad gene masked, but could be transmitted. 25% bad-bad, bad reinforcement, lethal or disabling. But under his modified primary assumption, Sheffield assumed that the priest scientist would discard bad stock as displayed in zygotes, which would eliminate the fourth group, bad bad, and leave a parent zygote distribution for this site of 33 1/3% good good, 33 1/3% good bad, 33 1/3% good bad. Such culling gave marked improvement over the original random chance situation, and meiotic division would produce gametes, both sperm and ova, in this incidence. Good, 4 out of 6, and bad, 2 out of 6. But with no way to detect the bad genes without destroying the gametes carrying them. Or so Sheffield assumed, while stipulating that the assumption might not be true forever. But to protect Yida and Joe, it was necessary that his assumptions be pessimistic within the limits of available data and knowledge, i.e., that a bad gene could be spotted only as reinforcement in a zygote. Sheffield reminded himself that the situation was never as black and white as was implied by good dominant and bad recessive. These descriptions were less complex than the real world they were used to image. A characteristic exhibited by an adult zygote was pro-survival or contra-survival only in terms of what and when and where, and also in terms of more than one generation. An adult who died saving its progeny had to be counted a pro-survival, whereas a cat that ate her own young was contra-survival, no matter how long she lived. In the same vein, a dominant gene sometimes was of no importance one way or the other, e.g., brown eyes, just as its corresponding recessive, when paired and thereby reinforced to produce blue eyes, gave the zygotes exhibiting it no measurable disadvantage. The same was true of many other inheritable characteristics, hair patterns, skin color, etc. Nevertheless, this description, good dominant, bad recessive, was in essence correct. It synopsized the mechanisms by which a race conserved its favorable mutations and destroyed, eventually, its unfavorable mutations. Bad dominant was almost a contradiction in terms, as a thoroughly bad mutation, which was dominant, killed itself off, along with the unfortunate zygote inheriting it, in one generation, either lethal in womb or so damaging to the zygote that it failed to reproduce. But the usual weeding process involved bad recessives. These could remain in the gene pool until one of two events happened, each controlled by the blind laws of chance. Such a gene could pair with a gene like it when sperm fertilized ovum, and thereby eliminate itself by eliminating the zygote, hopefully before birth, or tragically, after birth. Or this bad recessive might be eliminated by chromosome reduction at meiosis, and the result would be a healthy baby who did not carry this bad gene in its gonads. A happy outcome. Both these statistical processes slowly weeded out bad genes from the race's gene pool. Unfortunately, the first of these processes often produced babies viable, but so handicapped that they needed help to stay alive, sometimes needing economic help, born losers who never managed to support themselves, sometimes needing plastic surgery or endocrine therapy or other interventions or supports. When Captain Aaron Sheffield had been practicing medicine, on Ormuzd and under another name, he had gone through stages of increasing frustration over these poor unfortunates. At first he had tried to practice therapy by the Hippocratic Oath, or close to it. He was by temperament unable to follow any man-made rule blindly. Then he had had a period of temporary mental aberrance, during which he had sought a political solution to what he saw as a great danger, reproduction by defectives. He tried to persuade his colleagues to refuse therapy to hereditary defectives unless they were sterile or sterilized or willing to accept being sterilized as a precondition for receiving therapy. Worse yet, he had attempted to include in the definition of hereditary defective those who displayed no stigmata, save that they had never managed to be self-supporting. On a planet not overcrowded and which he himself had selected centuries earlier, as nearly ideal for human beings. He got nowhere. He encountered nothing but fury and contempt, save for a few colleagues who agreed with him privately and denounced him publicly. As for laymen, tar and feathers was the mildest medicine they prescribed for Dr. Genocide.
When his license to practice was lifted, Lazarus regained his normal emotional detachment. He shut up, realizing that grim old Mother Nature, red of tooth and claw, invariably punished damn fools who tried to ignore her or to repeal her ordinances. He need not interfere. So he moved and changed his name again, and started to get ready to go off-planet, when a plague hit Ormuzd. He had shrugged and gone back to work, an unfrocked physician whose services were temporarily welcome. 2 years and a quarter of a billion deaths later, he was offered his license back, subject to good behavior. He told them what to do with that license and left Ormuzd as quickly as possible, 11 years later. He was a professional gambler during that wait, that being the handiest way he could see at the time for saving up the necessary.
Sorry, Minerva. I was talking about those mirror twins. So, a silly little wench was knocked up, which caused me to slip back into my baby-coaching country doctor persona, and I stayed up all night worrying about her and her brother and the baby they were going to have, unless I did something about it. To find out what I should do, I had to reconstruct what had happened, and from that, what could happen. Having no certain data, I had to follow that old rule for finding a lost mule. First, I had to think like that slave factor. A man who auctions slaves is a scoundrel, but too smart to risk a caper in which he might wind up a slave himself. Or dead, if he was lucky. Which is what would happen to one who played fast and loose on Blessed with the authority of a bishop. Ergo, the scoundrel had believed what he had said. That being so, I could table the question of why this factor was commissioned to sell these two, while I tried to think like a priest-scientist engaged in human biological experimentation.
Forget the chance that these two were ordinary siblings. No point in picking such a pair even for a swindle.
Forget the chance that they were unrelated in any fashion. As in such a case, it would simply be a normal case of breeding. Sure, any woman can give birth to a monster. As even with the most genetically hygienic of breeding, a bad mutation can show up. And an alert midwife may neglect to give that first life-giving spank, and many have. So I considered only the third hypothesis. Complementary diploids from the same parents. What would this experimenter do? What would I do? I would use as near perfect stock as I could find and not start the experiment until I had both a male and a female parent who tested clean genetically, in the most subtle ways for which I could test, which on Blessed meant quite sophisticated ways for that century. For a selected gene site, and an assumption of 50-50 in the Mendelian distribution of 25-50-25, this pre-experiment testing would chop off the 25% chance of reinforcement of a bad recessive and leave a distribution of one-third bad, two-thirds good at the parent generation. Possible parents of possible Joes and Yidas, that is. Now I start putting together mirror twins in my persona as a priest experimenter. What happens? If we consider the minimum number of gametes needed to represent this one-third and two-thirds distribution, we get 18 possible Joes, 18 possible Yidas, but in both male and female, two of them show up as bad. The bad recessive has reinforced and the zygote is defective. The experimenter eliminates them, or he may not need to. The reinforcement may be lethal. We wind up at this point, with an 8 1/3% improvement, or a total improvement of 25% in favorable chances for Yida's baby. I felt better. If you add the fact that I am the sort of a midwife who is too busy helping the mother to stop to spank a monster, the favorable chances went way up. But all that this shows is that bad genes tend to be eliminated at each generation, with a tendency greatest at the worst genes and reaching 100% whenever reinforcement produces a lethal in-womb, while favorable genes are conserved. But we knew that, and it applies also to normal outbreeding and even more strongly to inbreeding, although the latter is not well thought of for humans, as it hikes up the chances of a defective by precisely the same amount that it weeds, that being the hazard that I was afraid of for Yeeta. Everybody wants the human gene pool cleaned up, but nobody wants its tragic aspects to take place in his own family. Minerva, I was beginning to think of these kids as my family. I still did not know anything about mirror twins. I decided to investigate a more probable incidence of bad recessive twins. I decided to investigate a more probable incidence of bad recessives at a given site. 50-50 is far too high for a really bad gene. The weeding is drastic and the incidence drops to a lower percentage each generation until the incidence of a particular bad gene is so low that reinforcement at fertilization is a rare event, as reinforcement is the square of the incidence. E.g., if 1 in 100 haploids carry this bad gene, then it will be reinforced 1 in 10,000 fertilizations. I speak of the total gene pool, or in this case a minimum of 200 adult zygotes, male and female. Random breeding in such a pool will bring together that bad reinforcement only by that long chance. A chance, happy or unhappy, depending on whether you look at it impersonally in terms of cleaning the gene pool, or personally in terms of individual human tragedy. I looked at it very personally. I wanted Yeeta to have a healthy baby. Minerva, I'm sure you recognize that 25-50-25 distribution is representing the most drastic case of inbreeding, one which can happen only half the time with line breeding, only a quarter of the time with full siblings, in both cases through chromosome reduction at meiosis. A stock breeder uses this drastic measure regularly and culls the defectives and winds up with a healthy, stabilized line. I have a nasty suspicion that such culling after inbreeding was sometimes used among royalty back on old Earth, but certainly such culling was not used often enough or drastically enough. Royalism might work well if kings and queens were treated like racehorses, but regrettably they never were. Instead, they were propped up like welfare clients and princelings who should have been culled were encouraged to breed like rabbits, bleeders, feeble-minded, you name it. When I was a kid, royalty was a bad joke based on the worst possible breeding methods. Captain Sheffield investigated next a lower incidence of a bad gene. Assume a lethal gene in the gene pool from which Joe and Yeeta's parents were derived. Being lethal, it could exist in an adult zygote only if it was masked in gene pair by its benign twin. Assume a 5% masked incidence in zygotes. Still too high to be realistic for a lethal gene, but check it anyhow. What trend would show? Parent zygote generation. 100 females, 100 males. Each possible parent for Yeeta and for Joe. And 5 of the females and 5 of the males carry the lethal gene masked. Parent haploid stage. 200 ova, 5 of which carry the lethal gene, 200 spermatozoa, 5 of which carry the lethal gene. Son and daughter zygote generation, possible Joes and possible Yeetas, 25 dead through reinforcement of lethal gene, 1,950 carrying the lethal gene masked, 38,025 clean at that site. Sheffield noted that a hypothetical hermaphrodite had crept in through not doubling his sample size in order to avoid anomaly through odd numbers. Oh, the hell with it. It did not change the statistical outcome. No, do it. Start with a sample of 200 males and 200 females with the same lethal gene incidence for that site. This gave him 400 ova, 10 with the lethal gene. 400 spermatozoa, 10 with that lethal gene. Which gave, in the next zygote generation, possible Joes and Yeetas, 100 dead, 7,800 carriers, 152,100 clean, which changed no percentages, but got rid of that imaginary hermaphrodite. Sheffield considered briefly the love life of an hermaphrodite, then got back to work. The numbers became very cumbersome, jumping to the billions in the next zygote generation, i.e., little nameless, now just starting in Yida's belly. 15,210,000, culled by reinforcement. 1,216,800,000 carriers. 24,336,000,000 clean. And again he wished for a clinic computer, and tediously converted the unhandy numbers into percentages. 0.059509%, 4.759%, 95.18% plus. This showed a decided improvement, approximately one defect out of 1,680, instead of one out of 1,600. The percentage of carriers decreased to below 5%, and the number of clean increased to above 95% in one generation. Sheffield worked several such problems to confirm what he had seen by inspection. A child from complementary diploids, mirror twins, had at least as much chance of being healthy as did the offspring of unrelated strangers, plus the happy fact that such a baby's chances were improved by culling at one or more stages by the priest scientist who had initiated the experiment. An almost certain assumption, and one that made Joe the best possible mate for his sister, rather than the worst. Yida could have her baby. Variations on a theme. 7. Valhalla to landfall.
I did the best I could for Minerva. Every so often some idiot tries to abolish marriage. Such attempts work as well as repealing the law of gravity, making pi equal to 3.0, or moving mountains by prayer. Marriage is not something thought up by priests and inflicted on mankind. Marriage is as much a part of mankind's evolutionary equipment as his eyes, and as useful to the races as eyes are to an individual. Surely marriage is an economic contract to provide for children and to take care of mothers while they bear kids and bring them up. But it is much more than that. It is the means this animal, Homo sapiens, has evolved, quite unconsciously, for performing this indispensable function and be happy while doing so. Why do bees split up into queens, drones, and workers, then live as one big family? Because for them it works. How is it that fish do okay with hardly a nodding acquaintance between mama fish and papa fish? Because the blind forces of evolution made that way work for them. Why is it that marriage, by whatever name, is a universal institution among human beings everywhere? Don't ask a theologian. Don't ask a lawyer. This institution existed long before it was codified by church or state. It works, that's all. For all its faults, it works far better by the only universal test, survival, than any of the endless inventions that shallow pates over the millennia have tried to substitute for it. I am not speaking monogamy. I mean all forms of marriage. Monogamy, polyandry, polygyny, plural and extended marriages with various frills. Marriage has endless customs, rules, arrangements, but it is marriage if and only if the arrangement both provides for children and compensates the adults. For human beings, the only acceptable compensation for the drawbacks of marriage lies in what men and women can give each other. I don't mean eros, Minerva. Sex baits the trap, but sex is not marriage, nor is it reason enough to stay married. Why buy a cow when milk is cheap? Companionship, partnership, mutual reassurance, someone to laugh with and grieve with, loyalty that accepts foibles, someone to touch, someone to hold your hand, these things are marriage. And sex is but the icing on the cake. Oh, that icing can be wonderfully tasty, but it is not the cake. A marriage can lose that tasty icing, say through accident, and still go on and on and on, giving deep happiness to those who share it. When I was a ruddy and ignorant youngster, this used to puzzle me. As solemnly ceremonious as I could swing, man lives by symbols,
I wanted them to remember this occasion. I had Yeeta dress in her notion of fanciest best. She looked like a blooming Christmas tree, but I told her she looked beautiful, which she did. Brides can't help it. Joe, I dressed in some of my clothes and gave them to him. Me, I dressed in a preposterous ship's captain uniform, one I had for use on planets where such nonsense is customary. 4 wide gold stripes on my cuffs, chest spangled with decorations bought in hawk shops, a cocked hat Admiral Lord Nelson would have envied, and the rest as fancy as any grand master of a lodge. I preached him a sermon loaded with solemn amphigory, most of it lifted from the only church they knew, the established religion of Blessed. Easy for me, having been a priest there myself. But I added all sorts of things, telling her what she owed him, telling him what he owed her, telling them both what they owed the child in her belly and the other children they would have, and tacked on for both, but primarily for her, a warning that marriage was not easy, not to be entered into lightly, because there would be troubles they must face together, grave troubles that would require the courage of the cowardly lion, the wisdom of the scarecrow, the loving heart of the tin woodsman, and the indomitable gallantry of Dorothy. That got her to weeping, so Joe started to drip tears, which was just what I wanted. So I had him kneel and prayed over them. Minerva, I make no apology for hypocrisy. I don't care whether some hypothetical god heard me or not. I wanted Yeeta and Joe to hear it. First in that jargon of Blessed, then in English and Galacta, then top it off by intoning as many lines of Aeneid as I could remember. When I got stuck, I closed with a schoolboy song. Omne bene sine poenam, tempus est londendi, finit hora absque mora libros deponendi. And ended with a resounding, so mote it be. Had him stand, take each other's hands, and declare that, by the supreme authority vested in me as master of a vessel in space, they were now and forever husband and wife. Kiss her, Joe. All to a muted background of Beethoven's Ninth. That doggerel got in by accident when I'd run out of punishment lines of Virgil and needed a few more impressive sounds. But when I thought about it later, I saw that it translated as appropriately for their honeymoon as for a school holiday. All was indeed well, now that I knew that this joining of siblings could take place without punishment, without fear of genetic punishment. Londendi translates as amorous play or eros as readily as gambling or child's play or any other frolic. And I declared a 4-day ship's holiday. No work for him, no study hours. Libros deponendi. Starting in once. Sheer accident, Minerva. It was simply a bit of Latin verse that came into my head. And Latin is majestic, especially when you don't understand it. We had a fancy supper, cooked by me. That lasted about 10 minutes for them. Yeeta could not eat, and Joe reminded me of Johnny's wedding night and why his mother-in-law fainted. So I piled a tray with tasty rations and handed it to Joe, and told him to get lost. I didn't want to see hide nor hair of him for 4 days. Then on to landfall, as fast as I could pick up a cargo. I cannot leave him on Valhalla. Jose was not yet able to support a family, and Yeeta was going to be limited in what she could do, either pregnant or with a new baby. Nor would I be on hand to pick him up if they fell down. They had to go to landfall. Oh, Yeeta could have survived on Valhalla, because they have the healthy attitude that a pregnant woman is prettier than the other sort, and that the farther along she is, the more beautiful she is. True in my opinion, and especially true in Yeeta's case. She had been passable when I bought her. When we grounded at Valhalla, she was almost 5 months gone and radiantly beautiful. If she went dirtside unescorted, the first 6 men she encountered would want to marry her. If she had had one on her back as well as one in her belly, she could have married well the day we arrived. Fertility was respected there, and the planet wasn't half filled up. I didn't think she would jilt Joe that quickly, but I did not want her head turned by too much male attention. I did not want to risk even an outside chance that Yeeta might leave him for some wealthy bourgeois or freeholder.
I had gone to much trouble to build up Joe's ego, but it was still fragile, and such a blow could kill it. He was standing tall and proud now, but his pride was based on being a married man with a wife and a child on the way. Did I mention that I had given them one of my names on their marriage certificate? They were now Frier og Fru Lang, Josef og Stjernje, for the duration of our stay on Valhalla, and I wanted them to remain Mr. and Mrs. Long for some years at least. Minerva, I had them take lifetime vows, never believing that they would keep them. Oh, ephemerals often stay married for life, but as for the rest, you don't find feathers.